Okay. Well, first of all, I need to thank the organizers of this very nice workshop, yeah, for putting it together and making it so enjoyable, well, and also for inviting me here to talk about this work. What I'm going to say will be based on some papers which appeared over the last years, together with Aaron and Irene, but also with Adrian Rühle and two of my excellent PhD students, Chongchul Li and Damian van der Heistwick. Okay, so what is the motivation for this talk or for our work? Is, well, thinking about the distance conjecture, you would expect that there's some sort of universal behavior arises if you approach infinite distance points in field space. Right? Because as you know, the distance conjecture states that there always should become, that there always should exist states which should become light in a certain rather universal fashion. And a second motivation can be taken from the asymptotic de Sitter conjecture by Uguri, Palti, Shiu, and Waffa, which is kind of a combination of the original thoughts on what the potentials in string theory should look like, together with the insights from the distance conjecture. So to my belief, this kind of asymptotic statement about the existence or non-existence of the de Sitter vacua is probably the thing which can be shown. And so the hope is to kind of make progress in understanding whether or not these things are actually like generally satisfied, and if there could be some underlying universal principle or structure which makes this happen. Okay. So the hope is that there is some abstract algebraic structure which might go much beyond normal just geometric settings in every asymptotic limit, which ensures that aspects or the whole conjectures are actually satisfied. Okay. So in contrast to the discussion yesterday, what this talk will be about is kind of, instead of looking at applications, phenomenological applications, I try to formalize it in some appropriate sense and connect it with some quite remarkable mathematics. Let me highlight already in the beginning that the structure I'm going to present was actually developed for geometries originally. So it came out of studying, like we do, we study Calabi-Yau manifolds, or in this case it's Fockeller manifolds. This structure arose from there, but starting from this, it can be abstracted to much more general situations. So it doesn't need to be an underlying geometric space. And if you think about the Swampland program, that's exactly what we are kind of heading for. So it's not only about kind of understanding what are properties of geometric spaces, but it's more like what are properties of compactifications in general, if you think about string theory, or what are the hidden structures, so to say, in effective theories which make these conjectures work. So in this sense, I have to mention here that I will be mostly concerned with the geometric manifestation. In fact, there are also versions of this story where you do that even more abstract over abstract periodic number fields and all kinds of things, where then things become even more fancy. Okay, so we now start with the following question. We want to study the moduli spaces or the field spaces which arise in string compactification, and we want to approach some asymptotic region where some of the fields and field space are becoming large. Yeah? And the reason why we approach these asymptotic regions is because if you want to have something like infinite distances, what we actually have to do is, since this can be shown to be a compact space, that we have to approach these kind of spikes towards the boundaries. So in some sense, there is some inner part of this which is in general very complicated, but in this we have a hard time often to treat the problems. But within each of these spikes, we will discover that there is a structure which is universal to the system. Okay. And later on, if I have the time, I will explain you that some of the important problems about, say, the landscape or the finiteness of the landscape actually have to be solved by studying the spikes, and they are in fact more or less trivially solved in the interior. So it's sometimes even true that this is the hard information and this is the easy information. Okay? Good. So this is the starting point. This is the question, and the starting point will be the following. I start with something which hopefully all of you are very familiar with. Namely, I will first mention that in string compactification, one of the things which is like all over the place and the key to most of these studies is the so-called Hodge norm. Namely, if I have some form field FP, then it appears in the Lagrangian with the Hodge norm, say, in a higher dimensional Lagrangian, for example. Okay. One important thing about this Hodge norm is that that's a positive thing, and it will be a very important concept throughout the talk and throughout much of the structure, that we want to keep these positivity conditions. Okay. So if you're not familiar with this way of writing things, it's just the contraction with the metric on the space, and like this. And so the non-trivial fact arises that, of course, if I changed the metric of the space I'm integrating over here, for example, I consider some manifold M and I change its metric, then this Hodge star actually will non-trivially change. Okay. So this Hodge norm is actually key in various things. For example, when you want to describe kinetic terms in effective theories. This Hodge norm is also important whenever you have, for example, you want to evaluate flux scalar potentials. In fact, that's always what happens, right? You reduce some higher dimensional theory with a positive kinetic term, and then you switch on some flux, you find a flux scalar potential which has this Hodge star form, and then maybe some topological corrections to it, and so on. This is equally true if you have brains, for example, right? Also, brain dynamics, you can describe their kinetic terms with this Hodge norm in a more general sense. So what are then these asymptotic compactifications? These asymptotic compactifications aim to study what is the behavior of this Hodge star or of this kind of norm once you approach the boundaries of field space, so the thing which I just removed. So this, of course, is in general a very complicated question, right? So to evaluate what happens to this when you change the metric and you go to the boundaries of the space. The way how you can approach it nevertheless, or simplify it or make it accessible, is to use the Hodge decomposition if you have a complex manifold. So now let's assume we have a Kähler manifold, and Kähler manifold M, then we can do the Hodge decomposition of the middle cohomology. I assume that it's a complex manifold of dimension D. Okay? So I can do the Hodge decomposition of the middle cohomology of this manifold, and it splits into D, 0 plus 0, D minus 1, 1, plus, and so on. Okay. And why does this help? Well, in fact, one can now show that if this is kind of a variation of the complex structure, then this Hodge decomposition actually changes much nicer, or has nicer properties than the change of the Hodge star. Right? In fact, you can show that all these kind of components change holomorphically. So the first one or the second one change holomorphically. The two things are related by noting that the Hodge star on a P, Q form takes this form. Right, so you can now evaluate the Hodge star on this decomposition, and you get an expression which only depends on this PQ decomposition. So, in other words, if you want to study the asymptotic behavior at the Hodge of the Hodge star, one way to do it is to study the asymptotic behavior of this PQ decomposition. So this works in this geometric setting, but it also works very abstractly if you can just find a deep PQ decomposition with the right properties, right? Abstract properties. Okay. So instead of kind of giving you now the full theory how to do that, I will mention a little bit how it works. I now turn it a little bit around as I...
Can I ask, is one inverted? Is it HQ, P, or is it literally like this?
This one? No, it's like this.
It's the same one.
Yeah. So now, what is the... I give you now the result of this theory, rather than introducing the theory, this mathematical theory in detail. Okay, so what is the emerging picture?
I'm confused with this down there. Normally, I would have thought the star of, for instance, H2, 1 is H1, 2. So the P and Q flip.
No? Star of the Z is D, I, D, Z, right?
Okay.
That's star of omega, so
thanks.
So what is the emerging picture? So we are now in one of these asymptotic regions, and in fact we are in any asymptotic region of complex structure moduli space. You can also do that for Kähler structure moduli space by mirror symmetry, or as I said, abstractly for any proper PQ decomposition which you can think of, operator algebras and so on. So now I zoom into one of these peaks, which I showed you before. I zoom into it. And what I do is I pick coordinates t1 to tn, and I say that moving into this peak corresponds to making the imaginary part of these coordinates very large. I can always find coordinates such that this is true. Then the idea is that if you are far out, like in the middle of this figure which I had before, or to the left of this peak, then we have just this Hodge norm of some form, which is very, very complicated in general, and you have the Hodge decomposition. And the Hodge decomposition.
Can you take n to be 1 to the number of moduli, or you will take...
So you can take...
Go to infinity.
So you can take... You can take any number of moduli in your theory to infinity. So think about, for example, a compactification which has, I don't know, on the quintic, which has 101 complex structural moduli. This, you can take one of them to infinity or 100. So this is what n determines. So there is secretly, there are other moduli in general, which are not taken to be infinity, and they are finite, right? Let's call them zeta. So now the interesting structure is that once you take this limit, you can actually go, so to say, to the limiting point, which is the boundary. So at this boundary, everything becomes very singular in general, right? Because you could do violent things to your manifold, or your limit could be such that everything kind of blows up. But the statement of this structure is that there is a way of kind of stripping off the infinities, which is captured by kind of these infinite limits, and then the thing which is left over is a finite piece. And this finite piece carries the key information about this boundary. And in fact, in kind of to make this like a little bit, put this into some nicer context, you could say that there is a boundary theory after taking the limit, which has certain very nice properties and can be specified. And as I will discuss later, can be classified. And the amazing thing is that this boundary theory now lives on this extremely singular space. That's what you have to keep in mind, right? So these limits are really wild. They can be really wild. For example, they can be decompactification limits if you think about Kähler moduli. So you just send volumes to infinity and your space becomes not anymore like a normal space, or you can generate singularities and so on. But this boundary theory exists on these singular spaces. Okay?
Boundary theory is a singular space, or boundary theory is something in addition to that? I'm a bit confused. What do you mean by so singular space? So as you go to the infinity and the marginal space, you get a singular map. Is that what you mean by the boundary theory, or something else?
No, I will explain what this boundary theory is. Okay. On very singular manifold. Okay. And now the key point is the following. This boundary theory on this very singular space actually determines how, for example, the Hodge norm behaves in the asymptotic region. So I can give you the data of this theory, and from this data you can determine how your Hodge norm looks like in this asymptotic region. Yeah. So there is some universal behavior determined by this boundary theory. Okay? Okay, now you might rightfully ask, what is this boundary theory? And that's the so the non-trivial part of the story is to say what this boundary theory is and how this boundary determines the Hodge norm in this asymptotic regime. Okay? So let me explain what this boundary theory is. So now, I describe what B consists of. So firstly, B consists of a decomposition of this middle cohomology, so of this middle cohomology into PQ type. Okay. So now, the important thing is to realize that this T dependence is completely gone because we are on the boundary. So everything can still depend on the coordinates which are not sent to a limit, but there is no T dependence, no? So this is the boundary decomposition. Boundary decomposition. T independent. And what I did is I stripped off the infinities. Okay. But because we have such a PQ decomposition, we can introduce something like a Hodge norm on the boundary, which I would call an analogy to this Hodge norm, norm infinity. Very good. But there is something else in this boundary theory which is absolutely key. Namely, this boundary theory, which I obtain by sending n coordinates to a limit, contains or is specified by n commuting SL2s. SL2 algebras acting on H, B. So what do I mean by this? I have raising operators, lowering operators, and kind of set components which raising, lowering, which commute like angular momentum. Okay. In fact, the existence of these operators on the boundary imply that I can split this space into eigenspaces, into spin eigenspaces, right? So I can split HD NDR into NEZ eigenspaces.
Just for someone who isn't very familiar with this, where are these NIs coming from?
This I will motivate later, where this comes from. I can already give you the intuitive argument because I probably have very little time to tell you where this comes from. So these NIs actually, they come from the fact that once you go very close to the boundary, you can classify the boundary by kind of circling around it or the singular locus, and you have some monodomy operation. if you want to think more physically, whenever you go to a boundary, you restore some kind of global symmetry. And this global symmetry is captured by this. And in fact, this is always a combination of SL2s, and it always, they are commuting.
Is it the same small n for each SL2?
No, there are n of them. They are n commuting SL2 algebras. Right. So for a limit of n variables, the natural thing to first do is to give n SL2 algebras to this limit. Yes?
Thomas, are you literally saying that if I take the moduli spaces we know, that their boundary, I guess you mean conformal boundary or something, they have all these killing vectors? Is that what you're saying? So if I take these coset spaces, which I can still have in n equal 2, these should be...
Yeah.
I mean, you say that you have commuting killing vectors there.
Well, I don't know how this kind of embed into this... how they embed into this actual geometric moduli space with the metric, right? So what I'm saying is, when you go to the boundary, what happens is that the moduli space becomes like multiple upper half planes. So it all looks a little bit like tori in a very rough analogy sense, in these limits.
Keyword, tori. I mean, in this limit, it's known that Calabi-Yau goes into SYZ vibration. So T3 fiber on the substrate dimensional base. And there's a complicated theory behind this, actually developed by Morrison locally and other people. And they are complicated, you know, skeleton diagrams, calcifying singularities, and so on. So somehow this must
So
fit into this.
Yeah? So absolutely, yeah. I didn't give the credit, so... So this kind of originally arise from the Griffith school, and Morrison is Griffith's student, and he actually also worked on asymptotic Hodge theory in his early parts of his career, and indeed this has manifestations like virtually everywhere, homological mirror symmetry, in all kinds of fields.
Can I think of each of the TI as an oxidilaton with SL2R acting on it, or
Well, asymptotically.
I mean, asymptotically, yeah.
Yes, somehow, yeah, asymptotically, yes. But it's a bit tricky, right? Because you have to think about that. Okay. Let's think about it like this.
One simple question on the origin. So I would have thought naively that there might have been a bigger monodrivy group overall, and you're saying there's sort of all of these subgroups that are relevant at the boundaries. Is it because the boundary is splitting into like n components and you can go around different divisors, or?
Yes, yeah.
Okay.
In some sense, let's say yes.
That's the rough picture.
So all the relevant monodromies are the axonic shift symmetries, GI goes to GI plus 1, or is there anything else?
Well, one has to be careful. These can be higher dimensional matrices. So in fact, they will be higher dimensional matrices depending on the boundary, and that's what I use to classify boundaries. So it's not only kind of these very simple shifts, but a monodromy, of course, is just T going to T plus 1. Okay. So I'm breaking down for you a very complicated theorem, which is called the SL2 orbit theorem. I break it down to some sort of rough picture of what is happening. And this goes back to Deligne, who invented kind of this underlying structure abstractly, and then most notably to Schmid and Catani and Kaplan. So Schmid is also a Griffith student, and well, Griffith should be first who kind of started this. Okay, very good. Now, what does that mean? That means that I can specify now my boundary theory over by specifying highest weight states of these SL2s. And then I can start acting with the creation and annihilation operators, or in this case, like lowering operators, to start from my highest weight states to give you the full spectrum. Like you can generate this full space by acting with these operators. So in other words, at the boundary, we have highest weight states. And because everything is commuting, I can write them in this beautiful way. I just write them like this. So it's like a spin chain at the boundary of moduli space, which classifies what happens at the boundary. And via this kind of continuation, it specifies what happens in this region close to the boundary. Okay. Maybe one thing which is remarkable, but is a little bit hidden, is the fact that the splitting into this SL2 happens actually over the real numbers. So that means that at every boundary, there exists a very special real structure which you have to pick. And this finding this real structure is very non-trivial. So if you want to construct these SL2s, finding this real structure is very non-trivial, but it exists. That's what is stating here.
Just for me to understand some of it, I mean, related to perhaps what Wolfgang really raised for us. But so if you think about this in the context of type 2b, for example,
yes,
and you take the mirror and ask what is the A model version of the statement, the large T's are large K-like classes, and we have the Picard-Lifshitz, we have the decomposition of cohomology in the usual form. But there's always one SL2.
Right.
Now here you're telling us there are many SL2. So in that language, what is the many SL2?
So it's indeed the mirror of this, of the Lefschetz decomposition, and this some of these theorems is kind of the mirror of the Hart-Lefschetz theorem. But as we know, we can have multiple Kähler forms if you look at.
But there's a continuous family. But you don't get you get only one SL2 decomposition. You don't change it.
That's true, but you could artificially switch on multiple directions and.
But you're not telling us that these SL2s are all identical.
No, they are
so
very
how
different.
How could it be in the mirror? They look all identical. That's what's confusing.
No, they are not in the mirror identical. They really correspond to switching on Kähler forms in which various moduli change in different directions. So you can really think of this like
in this case a canonical one. In other words, in the case of a Kähler map where there's a canonical Lifshitz decomposition, right?
Yeah.
So what is the analog of that here? Is there's a canonical SL2 for you? Or maybe there is something corresponding to the most maximal spin.
Exactly. There is one which corresponds to the
highest spin case.
Yeah. So which corresponds to the highest limit. No, I know what the answer is, but it's not easy to explain it quickly. Okay, very good. So, I have to speed up a little bit, but please ask questions. By the way, I think this presentation didn't appear anywhere like this, so I really try to design it to kind of that one gets an intuition for what is happening, and I hope at least the ideas become very clear and how general the story is. So then the next step is we classify the B's, the boundary theories, by representation theory. Plus keeping the positive norm. So the non-trivial part, probably the most non-trivial part, is that you have to make sure, however you go to the boundary in this limit, I didn't specify which path I'm taking, that kind of my norms stay positive. And then this turns into a very complicated higher dimensional problem. And as we know from the Swampland program, that's, or from all the Swampland conjectures, that's usually how you would try to violate conjectures, right? You take higher dimensional moduli spaces, you combine directions, and then you misalign them and so on. This structure gives you a way to show that certain things can never happen of this type. Okay, so we want to keep this positive norm, and so we can have, for example, for Calabi-Yau threefold, now I'm specifying the space which I'm working on, I can introduce these operators ni minus, which are the sum over the n, the kind of annihilation operators up to I. And then I can say, well, if my n minus I, kappa on the 3,0 at infinity is unequal to 0, so the highest kappa I can have, so the highest kappa which I can have here, it defines you what the boundary is, right? So for kappa equals to 0, I call this type 1. For kappa equals to 1, I call this type 2. For kappa equals to, and so on, right? 3 and kappa equals to 3, call this type 4. So when you want to think about this in the mirror side with the Kähler, in the Kähler side, you see that type 4 means that, so to say, your volume grows cubic, right? If you send this coordinate to infinity. In this coordinate, it grows cubically first. Here it grows quadratically, linear, and here it doesn't grow at all. This, of course, doesn't happen at large volume. But inside the moduli space, the conifold, this is exactly what happened. Okay? So these are the types, but that's not enough. So this is not specifying your boundary theory. So the non-trivial part is how many of the 2,1 forms actually also degenerate at the boundary. And this gives you a substructure A, B, C, D, and this subindex is determined by how many 2,1 forms at infinity are not annihilated. Okay, so this determines this index. And so what I'm claiming is that at least for the one parameter limits, which means in this case sending all of them to a limit in a certain way, these are the four H21 basic types from representation theory which you can have. Okay. Types of boundaries. But this cannot be enough, right? Because this is a higher dimensional problem, so it must be much more sophisticated than this. So if I'm in a higher dimensional moduli space, there should be some sort of dependence on how I approach this boundary, some sort of path dependence. And in fact, what happens here is you can get these types by sending like individual moduli to infinity. So you can start off sending a single modulus to infinity and then complete it one by one. So the actual SL2 structure here is classified by actually some chain. I mean, I don't know. I'm just giving something. Actually, chain. Why? Because you see, I used here Ni, which is the sum over the first n's, right? And now I can take I running from 1 to n. And then I pick up all of them. And then for each of these limits, I record what comes out. What kind of singularity type comes out. And this is kind of the basic building block which classifies this SL2 structure, this SL2 boundary theory.
Are the restrictions on the chains or not? Are there restrictions on these chains?
Yes. So abstractly now you can derive restrictions on the chain. You can now from representation theory and from the fact that the norm stays positive, you can derive what is allowed and what is forbidden. And this is purely purely algebraic, plus this norm condition.
And what is allowed does occur?
This is not known.
So it could be soft language for them.
Huh?
So it could be soft language?
Yeah, so this is exactly, yeah. Okay. So, unfortunately, this is not yet the end of the story, because...
So, there could be several ends, like four trees, that come by at the endpoint of three different, of various different chains. Is that possible? Yeah.
So these are really the same type of asymptotic structure. So they once you have them, you can actually map them to each other.
But is each endpoint the endpoint of precisely one chain, or could it be the endpoint of several chains?
Oh, this can be the endpoint of several chains. Actually, that's the next point which I want to make.
But does it matter in the end?
It does not matter for the endpoint, no. So once you're there, this is the same theory, if you want. But the actual boundary theory is not classified by these chains alone, but actually by a complete diagram of chains. So why? So the non-trivial part is if you're in a higher dimensional moduli space, say you have two directions, and I consider C1 equals to 0 and C2 equals to 0 to be the boundaries, and now I change coordinates from T to kind of the cover log Z. And for later on, I use phi plus I S. Please remember these names. So I could approach this boundary point, namely this one, where both of them are 0. I can approach them like this, or I can approach it like this. And in fact, these two limits correspond to two different chains. Right? Namely, depending on which of the coordinates grows the fastest. So in a higher dimensional moduli space, you have to take into account that you can take multiple limits. You can also go like this, growing them both at the same rate. So instead of having only a single chain, you actually have a complete diagram. Right, which corresponds to, so you start with a non-singular space, and then you take the various limits. Okay. So you start with a non-singular space, and then if I take one coordinate to infinity, I could get a certain type. I could take another coordinate to infinity, get a certain type. Or I could take, so I take a three moduli example, so I can get, depending on which modulus I send to infinity, can have a different component. Or I can take two of them to infinity, like these two. Sorry, I should draw it like this. These two, or these two, or these two. Right? And then I just take one example from the Kreutzer-Skarke list. Then I find, when I do things in Taylor moduli space, I find this picture. Or I can take all of them to infinity, and because I use mirror symmetry, this is the large volume point. So it's the maximal type. And what I'm now stating is that this diagram, the complete diagram, classifies the boundary theory. So it's an involved thing, but you have to think about what we are trying to do. We try to control a non-trivial function on every path reaching a certain point. So it must be some sort of non-trivial structure. And so for the information for the various paths are what theories can occur is kind of captured in this diagram. And in fact, if you use mirror symmetry, you can try to use this to classify Calabi-Yau manifold. You can classify them. So you can group them into manifolds which have the same boundary structure.
Yeah, people know how to classify Calabi-Yau. You're saying there's classification. You mean you can put each one to a class in that sense?
Yes,
but
exactly.
But you can't classify Calabi-Yau yet.
Well, yeah.
Okay, that's the same.
So you can each Calabi-Yau threefold which has a different diagram is topologically different.
But
there could be two Calabi-Yau manifolds which have the same diagram. Because in this structure we are dropping some information, and this information is precisely what I kind of
so there could be two or more Calabi-Yau with the same diagram, that could be some diagrams with no Calabi-Yau.
Yes. But what is not clear?
These diagrams don't have any Calabi-Yau because there are infinite many such diagrams, or not? And there are finite number of Calabi-Yaus.
Right. If the diagrams become very large, it's not clear anymore that there is a Calabi-Yau manifold too.
There are infinite many such diagrams you can write, right?
As it stands, yes, but there are rules. And these rules are very stringent.
But the rules doesn't cut into a finite set.
Not that I know. These rules are not known completely.
So you don't have the full swamp and rules.
Unfortunately, not. Yeah. But we are working on this. So we actually.
You're saying you're working, but mathematicians haven't tried to cut this down.
They have, and they have done it for two moduli. So they have cut it down. So you have the rules for two moduli. I know the rules. So I know what kind of things can talk to each other on the boundary. Abstractly.
It's not infinite. If the number of moduli is large, it would be huge, the number of possibilities, but it's not infinite.
No, so what I meant is
no, but you can make the diagram arbitrarily large as it stands.
But it stops at some point.
This number here, well, you're right. So if I know that H11 is bounded.
Yes, that's what my question. My question was, do you know anything?
Okay.
Yeah. So the length of this diagram is related to H11. But they are very intricate rules, and not all of. It's not clear that all of these are realized on manifolds. So it could be very well that there's something algebraic abstract which satisfies some allowed thing which we cannot write as a manifold.
Could I ask you, so how do we know these three or four or several four three types differ? Because so
no, they don't. They don't necessarily differ. No. They don't differ in its real structure. Okay. So now, good. This was admittedly abstract, but now I come back to the thing which I promised you in the beginning, namely that I tell you how the Hodge norm behaves in this asymptotic region. Right? Now, you from this structure you can do a lot of things, and actually some of the things is very much related to what Timo told us in these actual geometric settings. So let's see if I get to this quickly. So, but one equation I really have to provide you, namely, now how the Hodge norm is determining this universal behavior at the boundary.
Do you have information about the full Hodge star or just the Hodge norm?
You also have...
Very good.
Yeah. You also have information about, so to say, orthogonality, which I didn't say is that these SL2 eigenspaces actually respect the norm. It's kind of hidden in this notation. So everything splits into blocks at the boundary. And these blocks are orthogonal to each other. So you see that your complicated moduli space diagonalizes in a generalized sense on the boundary. Or if you think of this as charge spaces, then your charges of your B-brain states kind of diagonalize in blocks. Okay, so I promised you that I give you the asymptotic expression for the Hodge norm, and here it is. I have to sum over all the eigenspaces of these operators with Li eigenvalue, and then for the variables which become large, we have kind of this growth behavior up to n and then Ln. And then there is an object which is e to the minus pi I n I minus acting on alpha and this norm at infinity. And then this I have to restrict to the eigenspaces L1 to Ln. Okay. Eigenspaces. So what does that tell you? For example, if you give me a flux, right? I have a flux specified. Then what I have to do is I have to decompose the flux into this SL2 decomposition. And then I can plug it into this expression. And I know that, and I know exactly how every component of the flux grows at the boundary of moduli space. Right? So how it grows with these S which are becoming large. And this expression is valid for a certain behavior of how fast things are growing.
Sorry, Thomas?
Yes.
Maybe I missed it, but before we had T's and we had rows as moduli. Now you write S's and phi's.
Sorry. That's what I told you to remember. Phi's and S. That's the moment where you close the eye for
yeah.
No problem. Yeah. So the phi's are something like the axions, yeah. And the S are something like the saxions.
So usually in the mirror case, you have CIJK kind of things. Where are those? Are you suppressing constants?
What is CIJ case?
Like the K cubed and all the triple intersections?
Oh, no. They, I'm not suppressing anything. It's in this.
Oh, it's hidden.
It's in this norm.
I see.
Yeah.
So what do you know about those?
No, I know. No, these are determined by the intersection numbers, these n's. So what I do is I kind of...
So if I wanted to classify the triple intersection of Miracle Abiyaz, would you be able to tell us anything?
Yeah, that's exactly what I meant, what I did.
So what can you tell me, for example, 5t cubed or a cum t could have been allowed, but 4t cubed is not allowed?
No, this I cannot tell you. You mean like an overall factor?
Yeah, yeah.
No, this I cannot tell you.
So what are you going to tell us then? Is the relative numbers?
Exactly, the relative numbers. So I can tell you what kind of intersection patterns you can have. relative intersection pattern such that this is consistent, that it always leads to a positive norm. Yeah. So, and I can tell you certain things about growth. So something which we heard before. So if I send one cycle to infinity, there always has to be a cycle, another cycle which shrinks or something like that. And this actually follows from this equation. Okay. Since I want to get to the applications, then I just say in words why this structure, because I said it already. Why this structure? So this structure actually arises from the fact that close to the boundary we have these monodomy symmetries, and these monodomy symmetries translate to this n structure there. Okay. In other words, if you want to have it more physically, you can say that at every boundary in this moduli space, you have a perturbative expansion plus a non-perturbative expansion. At every boundary, you can always find coordinates such that there is a finite perturbative expansion and some non-perturbative expansion. And I can, because I'm close to the boundary, get rid of this. Right? And so this asymptotic Hodge theory is actually a theory about the behavior of this finite expansion. And that should ring a little bit a bell, because if you would have no supersymmetry, it's not clear to me that there is a finite, well, it's clear to me that there's no obvious finite perturbative expansion. So in fact, this kind of structure is in some sense related to the supersymmetry plays a role, right? So what you might be hoping, and people try this, is kind of to infer kind of leading behaviors of amplitudes using this structure. Okay. So now I introduced all this structure, and I should maybe just mention what this structure actually is called a limiting mixed Hodge structure. And in the last 15 minutes or so, I will tell you now how one can use this to address the swampland conjectures. I'm sorry that I have to go through this to some extent, but of course I could just tell you what we are doing in these conjectures, and you have no idea why this should ever be true. But I encourage you, if you ever worked on flux compactification or any large volume compactification or anything, translate it into the structure and you will see it fits on the nose. So you see all this kind of growth of various components and so on, as it should be. Because
it's a way to get to the next, the leading non-perturbative.
Yeah, there is, actually. There is a way to get to the leading non-perturbative state. So you might have said, well, look, at the Kone fold, for example, the leading non-perturbative term is very important. And the problem is a little bit that I hide one thing, is that this expansion is not only true for the 3-0 form, but also for the 3-0 plus 2-1 forms. And that's how you can approach the Kone fold, or you can capture the Kone fold. So the Kone fold is type 1, so it's at finite distance, but it has kind of a higher index because more 2-1 forms have blown up in the limit. So you get, indeed, you can address the leading non-perturbative. Or if you have a shrinking K3, for example, you also need non-perturbative corrections. It's also captured by the structure. So this, it's just in the positivity of of these norms. So it essentially tells you that you have to have this leading non-perturbative correction in certain situations. Okay, so now swampland and landscape. The first observation which you make is if you use this equation to evaluate the Kähler potential, you see that at an infinite distance point, it's actually independent of the axion, exactly because of this factor here, this exponential factor. So at infinite distance boundaries, so infinite distance are exactly the types 2, 3, 4, and so on. In color, we are fourfold, it goes higher. You can check that this means infinite distance. Then you can compute the Kähler potential, which is just minus logarithm of omega, which omega bar. And you see, if you plug in this leading expression, you see that the axion dependence drops out. So there is no axion in the Kähler potential, so there is a global shift symmetry. Asymptotically. So at the infinite distance boundary, I get a global symmetry. This is in contrast, or it's in contradiction with the swampland ideas. There should be no global symmetries. Well, we know, or we believe that the distance conjecture should come to our rescue. In fact, if we consider color, if we consider type to be on a Calabial threefold, and we consider D brains which have charges in this middle cohomology, so the space which we are talking about all the time. So these are the D3 brain charges. Then the SL2s, so the SL2s allow us to split this space. These SL2s allow us to split this space into at least over the reals, like in all examples, also over Q, into V light plus V heavy plus V rest. So this V light are all the D brain states whose norm, or all the charges whose norm vanishes at the boundary, while these are the ones which become infinitely massive at the boundary. So what the structure actually tells you is that there is a symplectic split into V light and V heavy, and you see this from this and SL2 representation theory. So to every state, if you have a direction which becomes infinitely light at the boundary, which kind of dies off polynomial, there will be another direction which grows polynomially at the boundary. And this is this kind of thing. In fact, these lights and the heavy, they have to have non-trivial intersection.
So for you, omega, which omega bar was 1, the integral of holomorphic free form in this sense is 1 or not? Are you fixing that?
Well, I have to fix some overall scaling.
That's what that means.
Yeah.
You have to put it by assumption.
You have to put some overall scaling, and then you can read off the leading behavior of... This is just the leading behavior in the mirror of the volume, if you want. But everywhere in moduli space, not just in large complex structure.
The overall volume is quote-unquote 1.
Yes. Yeah, well, this is the correct way to do it, because the Hodge norm is actually independent of this, freedom which you're describing of rescaling omega. Yeah. So this is all correct. The thing which is not 100% correct is this expression, because this is only true up to an overall rescaling.
So what I meant is the mirror language, you have to fix the overall volume.
Yeah. You can fix the overall volume, yes.
It's like in black lines.
Something like this, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Very good. So what we then have shown, I will just say it in words, that at infinite distance boundaries, the light is actually non-empty, and in many cases it can be generated by this SL2 generator. So in other words, you can use the SL2 creation operator to create more and more states in this V-light direction. And this is corresponding to this tower of light states, as already the name indicates. So this is quite remarkable, and the fact that these states are there comes, or potentially are there, of course, actually shown is a complicated thing, but that they are potentially there comes from the fact that we are at infinite distance, because otherwise these spaces can be empty. And they actually also they also talk to the graviphoton. Furthermore, I was mentioned. It was said that I will say something about the gauge coupling function. In fact, already in our earliest paper with Irene and Aaron, we talked about the gauge coupling function. This structure tells you that at every boundary you can find a basis where you have an electric field which becomes weakly coupled. That's what the SL2 structure tells you, right? Because you can always find the Ls, they can be positive and negative, and there's always as many positive as negative because of SL2. And you can always find a basis where you work in the weakly coupled theory. There's always a weakly coupled gauge theory at these infinite distance boundaries. And what you can also show is that the theta angle in this weakly coupled theory takes a very specific simple form. And this simple form arises from this R-split structure, which always exists at every boundary. So in other words, the theta angle in the boundary theory vanishes for theta, well, the real part m I j, m i j vanishes at boundary and is proportional to phi. So this is very, if you do this computation directly from the pre-potential, you find that it's not vanishing because of the Euler characteristic corrections. There is a constant correction of the theta angle if you take the fully corrected pre-potential. But the structure tells you that you can always rotate to a basis, which is called an R-split basis, where you rotate this dependence out and this becomes proportional to the axons. And it's very reminiscent which you had in the rigid case. So if you have no axion, then it's completely real or zero. And you use the, in the paper by Ciccotti and Buffer, you use the intuition from the large complex structure point. Yeah, this, you can see some of this realness. What I'm saying here is that this has nothing to do with large complex structure, but it's actually true in every limit.
The reality structure is also there at every limit?
Yes. Yes. It's there in every limit. And it's... Yeah. Okay.
So it's a cycle collapse associated with V light. You can think of the Hadamard going to zero in some dual way of thinking of a cycle collapse. Is that right?
You say again?
You have D3 rings wrapped on three cycles that are collapsing down at the boundary.
Yeah.
So just a question. I mean, so like this is, I don't think I heard this weakly coupled result that's really interesting previously. I mean, so for instance, if these three cycles are becoming like the electric cycles, there you can, does it follow automatically that dual magnetic cycles are not also becoming small?
Yeah, so it follows from the structure that at these boundaries, there is something, when you make something small, something has to become large if you want to keep the overall normalization.
I see. And
this comes from this dual structure.
So if the electric states are coming down, the magnetic states sort of by definition can't, and this is fully consistent with the weakly coupled electric story at the boundary. Thanks.
So if I'm moving this from a 2B click thing, is the volume being kept constant here, or is the...
This is the precise question which was asked before. Yeah, so this now depends on what precisely you want to do. Like for these kinetic terms here, this is independent of the normalization of the volume, the Hodge norm. Like because if you expand this into omega, you always have to divide by omega which omega bar. And so this kind of rescaling do not matter. But if you want to study limit in Kähler moduli space, you can either consider limits where you send the volume to, where you just keep the volume unfixed and everything goes to infinity, or you try to kind of fix it artificially. And then the statement is that there's always a dual structure. Once you do the fix, there's always a dual structure.
So the limit when the volume goes to infinity, what sort of the action of this the SL2, what are the states generated by this SL2? If I just like the decompactification limit, where?
This is where kind of D6 brains go, D6, D4, D2, and D0 brain states. And these are the ones which kind of get kind of mapped into each other by this creation and annihilation operator.
Well, I think that the physical thing is what Irina also said, that in the physical sense, you always get light and heavy relative to time scale. In the Einstein frame, you have to keep the volume fixed, and that's equivalent to saying that's the same as the Hodge norm is defined.
Yeah.
Well, you can study the Hodge norm and see that all these masses diverge if you wish, but like this splitting, the fact that some things are light and others are heavy, is always in Einstein frame, like with respect to the Planck scale.
Yeah, so it's kind of where you set the medium. You could also have some overall scaling.
With the Einstein frame, you don't have a choice.
No. In the physical sense, you have no choice if you want to look into the effective theory and measure.
Would that happen that in Einstein frame everything became real light?
Yeah.
Exactly.
It
doesn't happen though.
So maybe I should stress this. This structure is very, very non-trivial. And it has nothing to do a priori with the symplectic structure of the middle cohomology of Calabi-Yau threefold, because the symplectic structure also exists for Calabi-Yau fourfolds and for it. It's actually the fact that you have SL2s which have like spin up and spin down states.
So for decompactification tied to A, what you get is D2 and D0 and D2 become light in Planck units, and D4 and D6 become heavy, right?
Yes. That's what we found. Yeah. Well, explained. Yeah. Okay. So then, the thing. So this is already slightly older. This is something ongoing, which we are looking at now. And but the thing which really excites me the most at the moment is the fact that we can use this to study flux compactification. So all of this would be... So the exciting thing is that we now have a handle to address the kind of these DeSitter conjectures and ask if there is some non-trivial structure which makes them work. And that's what you could kind of summarize in the name asymptotic flux compactification. And what we did is we studied the scalar potential which arises from G4 flux and studied all asymptotic forms of this scalar potential. And in doing this, we were able to test the asymptotic De Sitter conjecture for infinite distance boundaries, abstractly. So it's not that we looked at any examples or anything like this. We just took this structure, asked what are the forms of all the asymptotic potentials, and checked if this conjecture is true.
And so if we do the abstract, you get the universal number for the best bound?
No, this, it's
related to these L's, like these eigenvalues. We can give.
Oh, yeah, and since you don't classify, you don't want the L's.
So we know the kind of the we can classify what L's could be. These are just numbers which range from, I don't know, -4 to 4 or something like this. But you have a whole pattern of numbers.
See, does not depend on H1, 2, H2, H3, 1.
See, it does not. Well, this we.
No, I don't think it does. I mean, it depends on the L's, but the L's are bounded.
Yeah, I don't know. We did it for two moduli. So. It would be very interesting to.
It would be interesting if you can come up with a universal constant.
Yeah.
So is this on chapter A or in what?
This is just for this F theory potential, but we tested it even more generally with kind of plugging this to be a constant C and allowing for prefactors, and then it also captures the type 2A case. So it's really just in the structure of this. Of these asymptotic norm behaviors.
So for this, does one need to know also what then, say, to the Kähler moduli, if I think this of N theory?
If you want to find a De Sitter, yes. Yeah. But what the non-trivial part of the statement is, even if you don't care about the Kähler moduli, already the structure inside this piece makes sure that you cannot have this. So it seems to be something universally there in all pieces of the story. It's not a combination of everything which makes these work. Is that clear? Okay.
Like saying that there is this time cycle for any scalar direction. So even if you focus only on some directions, in the other ones, you're going to have this runaway there, right? So it's not going to be a minimum.
So
you're not finding non-vanishing F term for the convex vector moduli. I mean, minimum.
Which are, yeah. Which are positive.
If you did, then you would have a runaway volume dependence, which you'd have to.
Exactly.
If you find one, you have to study the other directions, but already in this direction, it's not possible.
Exactly. So
the idea that in every asymptotic direction, you should not be able to get rid of this runaway.
So it's exactly. So, of course, if we would have found the De Sitter minimum, we wouldn't say that the De Sitter conjecture is wrong, right? Because we didn't study the Kähler moduli. But the point is that this is deeper than this. It's not a combination of everything. It's somehow inside the structure in each piece of the story. So even in the complex structure side. Yeah.
In 2A, does it also capture a Roman smith?
Well, in the type, as I said, so if I kind of keep this a constant and allow overall factors on the volume, one of these asymptotic potentials is precisely the type 2A potential. So it contains the Roman's mass, yes.
The only thing that confuses me is at no point have you used more string information like tetpole constraints or charge quantization.
Right.
So what's a little confusing is that we take the existing type 2A solutions, which we know are all at strong coupling or at small volume. I think that ceases to exist if I allow myself to crank up or anti-fault numbers to arbitrarily magnitude. Okay, then I think these existing solutions all become weakly coupled and at large volume.
But since you haven't used that information, I cannot not understand why you don't, we don't see these fake solutions.
Well, no, no, no. I mean, first of all, I don't know precisely what kind of type 2A setting you have in mind.
I think it's fine because this is just a parametric control. So we are assuming that we cannot just take the coefficients to be arbitrary large.
So I would need one of these coefficients to go to infinity. Okay.
But we also explain, well, yes, but we also explain how one could design fluxes where you can make these coefficients arbitrary large. And even in this case, we find that you get ADS vacua, but never de Sitter vacua. So it's, there seems to be something deeper in this structure, which is which goes beyond. It's about kind of combining ingredients with the right sign of the metric.
Yeah. Maybe if I can say, like, what we did is everything that does not appear in this statport condition, like the G4 was G4, then we can allow it to be large, but everything that appears cannot be large. That's going to reduce to the Ossis planes.
Okay, so.
One more question? Yes. For the statement, did you use only the leading order polynomial term or the whole polynomial expansion?
For this statement, I think we used the whole expansion. But the whole in the sense of this asymptotic expression.
So you're only getting rid of
we get rid of the instanton corrections, and we have to restrict ourselves to a sector where, so to say, off-diagonal terms die off sufficiently fast. But you can do that for every sector, and so this is very nice. But I think the most important test which we are doing at the moment is to use this technology to show finiteness statements. So, for example, it's a long-standing question if the number of supersymmetric flux vacua or of the number of vacua is finite. So. So you can ask the question, are the number of supersymmetric vacua of this theory with this potential finite? Supersymmetric vacua are vacua of type 2-2. Okay. And what this means mathematically is that they define something which is called a Hodge class. And the remarkable thing is now, to show that there are only finitely many, there are two ways of doing it. One is using the Hodge conjecture. Right? And of course you have to use the fact that G4, wedge G4 is bounded. And then you can show that it's finitely many. The other way of doing it, and this is a very famous result, by Catani, Delin, and Kaplan, you can actually prove it using asymptotic Hodge theory. And what you actually have to use is exactly the technology which I introduced. And this theorem, or this result, is widely considered kind of the best evidence for the Hodge conjecture. So it's a very non-trivial proof that this is finite. And it's the tricky part is controlling these infinitely many paths which you can use to approach the boundaries. So you have to make sure that along none of these paths you pick up infinitely many flux vacua. And what we are doing now is we are trying to show that this is also true for finite. So, So that's what you are thinking about with what I'm thinking about with Christian Schnell from Stony Brook, like actual expert on this field.
Thomas, just a question about these two arrows. So in the first case, you're using the Hodge conjecture to get you some sort of integrality, and then using sort of the ball defined by integral g4 log g4. Is that right? It's really integrality that's giving you finiteness there.
Oh, yes.
And the point is that nowhere in the bottom arrow are you making that integrality restriction. You're not assuming the Hodge conjecture, but nevertheless, it seems to be true.
Now, if you want to show this, you also have to make the integrality restriction. And there comes this discussion about clockwork and all these things which we had yesterday. So this is like the abstract version of these sort of things. So if you what you could try to do is you could say you have integral things, but you kind of misalign things very much such that kind of things die off slowly in one direction. But this proof shows you, at least for this question, this never allows you to pick up infinitely many things. Yeah. Now, of course, what we want as physicists is how many can I pick up? Like, what is this finiteness, right? So that would be the cool next step, which I'm not achieving.
Okay. This brings me. This finiteness statement. I mean, it's only in the asymptotic limit. How am I supposed to?
No. So this is exactly a situation where the thing happens, which I explained. The finiteness is the tricky part about finiteness is in the asymptotic regimes. In the middle of the moduli space, you have only finitely many things, but in the boundaries, you could pick up these infinite tails.
And it's also impossible to pick up infinitely many things near a finiteness of singularity. So this is in general, just for all types of singularity.
You mean this finiteness? Oh, this is general in the whole moduli space. So what is very interesting is the observation that in these type 2a vacua, the ones which we either very much hate or very much like, you have exactly these infinite tails. So, and in type 2b, these are always cut off.
Any other questions? No, this time, I was, yeah.